Hello and welcome to the Politics Home podcast. I'm Matt Honeycomb-Foster, news editor here at Politics Home. The coronavirus outbreak is now officially a global pandemic, with markets crashing, cases mounting, and even a health minister being struck down with the respiratory disease. The virus's spread, of course, couldn't help but overshadow what was expected to be the big UK news story of the week, Rishi Sunak's first budget as Chancellor, and he dedicated a full 17 minutes of the big fiscal statement to government plans to combat corona. We'll be digging into the detail of the government's response, asking why the UK is going down a different route to some other countries, and asking whether it's really viable for Parliament to stay open. Then we'll chew over the rest of the big spending budget as the Tories tossed all talk of austerity to one side, tried to make good on their election vow to level up Britain. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by a favourite of the podcast, New Statesman's Britain editor, Anoush Chikhalian, who has written a lot about the hidden toll of the decade-long squeeze on public spending. Great to have you here, Anoush.
Thank you.
Without prompting, yesterday you described this as the muck-busted of podcasts, so an excellent crossover we can all enjoy. And a man whose viral tweets are close to being labelled a pandemic by the WHO. I'm sorry.
Viral tweets?
Yeah, whatever. I'm doing my best.
I think it's a compliment. I think.
Of course, you'll recognise the voice. Paul Home Editor, Ken Schofield, is back.
Hi, Matt. Hello, Anoush.
Hello.
So let's start off by talking about the coronavirus, which has, of course, dominated everything that's going on in Westminster this week. Kevin, you're just back from the latest lobby briefing. We've got COBRA coming up as we record this, and the PM's chairing it. What are we expecting from that meeting? What's the kind of latest?
Well, we're going to move from the containment phase, which was the phase where the government and scientists thought they could potentially contain the virus so it wouldn't spread across the country. They've given up any hope of that, and now we're going to move to the delay phase, which essentially the aim of that is to delay the peak of the number of cases to the summer. So not just to delay it, but also to flatten it out so not so many people get it, but also that it will be in the summer when it gets really, really bad. And the thinking is by then, well, two things really. One, there'll be less pressure on the NHS, and also potentially the virus itself might not be as virulent because of the warmer weather. So that's the theory anyway. So we're expecting that to be confirmed later on this afternoon. We're probably going to get a press conference, I think, with the Prime Minister again, Chief Medical Officer and the Chief Scientific Advisor later on today.
What kind of measures could we expect to see as we move into that delay phase? How will life change, do you think? I mean, not to preempt it, but...
Yeah, well, according to the plan that the government published last week, there'll be more restrictions potentially on large gatherings, so things like sports events might have to either be cancelled or be held behind closed doors. School closures is something else. Social distancing is what they call it, is basically to try and keep us further apart from one another, basically to reduce the risk of spreading the virus. But a lot of the other stuff that's already happening in terms of, they call it contact tracing, so if someone has been diagnosed with it, they will find out who they've been in contact with and go down that chain to try and establish whether other people have got it. That will continue, but as I say, it's now a case of, rather than trying to contain the virus, it's trying to delay the worst effects of it.
Now, this was front and centre of the budget yesterday. What were the kind of big coronavirus-related announcements from Rishi Sunak yesterday?
Well, there was a whole host of stuff basically to help businesses, employees and benefit claimants who are inevitably all going to lose financially. And if you're forced to take time off work sick at the moment, you don't get statutory sick pay until day four that you're off. They're bringing that forward to day one. There's things like business rate holidays, or business rates basically being cancelled for a year for lots and lots of businesses like cinemas, restaurants, museums, smaller businesses, which will really struggle as their cash flow essentially dries up. And things for like benefit claimants, things like they won't be penalised if they can't turn up for interviews because they're self-isolating at home, because or if they've got the disease or if they've got symptoms. So all these types of things. I mean, very expensive promises. In total, it comes to £30 billion, so a lot of money, but it's the type of thing that I guess the government has got to basically spend whatever it takes, or else the alternative is, well, it doesn't really bear thinking about.
Anoush, as Kevin kind of mentioned there, the NHS has been promised kind of whatever it needs to deal with this. Where do you think that cash is likely to be most urgently required at the moment?
Well, one of the main concerns, I think, in terms of the NHS is its capacity to deal with so many people having to be hospitalised at once, which we already know it struggles with, even without this virus. So I think it will be trying to increase capacity. It will also be trying to ensure that there are enough doctors and nurses and other health workers to actually treat the people who are coming in and deal with the massively higher caseload, and that's been a problem again before this virus even existed, especially with the changes to the immigration system that are coming up and also the effects since the EU referendum result on the number of nurses, the number of other healthcare workers, because we rely so much on people from Europe and outside of the EU to do those jobs. So those will be the two, I think, sort of big flashpoints for the NHS, and hopefully some of that money can help. But the big problem here is that money is going straight to the NHS rather than social care, which is the care in the community, which has been suffering so much because it's funded by local government. Without that new money for social care, which wasn't announced in the budget, it was barely mentioned, there will still be a massive pressure on the NHS.
Another area that's, you know, been kind of leading the charge on this is Public Health England and Public Health Services. What kind of state are those in at the moment around the country?
Really bad, actually. I mean, we've had 10 years of austerity, and although it sort of generally seems to bore people to tears to talk about the cuts, especially since it was sort of Labour's main message in the previous two elections and didn't really seem to resonate with the electorate, it nevertheless is true. I mean, all you have to do is, you know, look at the public services around you, not only health-related, but otherwise too, like libraries and youth centres and other places that have a good impact on our health and mental health, but is not so direct. Those things have been sort of crumbling before our eyes because councils are legally required to pay for social care, so child services and adult social care services, but there are other things that aren't statutory duties, so those things inevitably fall away.
Kevin, are we in for a bumpy ride generally? Is the economy likely to take a big hit if this thing gets worse?
Well, on the morning of the budget, before Rishi Sunak got up to speak, the ONS, Office for National Statistics, published the GDP figures for the last 3 months of 2019. So that's before coronavirus came along, and it was zero growth, literally 0.0% growth. So already the economy was already teetering on the brink of a contraction. You throw in the economic impact of coronavirus, and it's inevitable, I think, that we're heading for a recession. I mean, he didn't say the word yesterday, but it was pretty clear that he was softening us up for a fairly bumpy, certainly first 6 months of this year. I mean, what the government is desperately hoping is that this is a temporary blip, so it'll be really bad, but the economy will bounce back quickly as the virus passes, people get better and go back to work. So in that sense, it would be different from the 2008 crash, which was obviously much more long-lasting and a much deeper impact. But we simply don't know if that's the case. You know, I mean, China is looking relatively positive that their cases have come down quite a lot. But because it's a new virus, they've got no idea how it's going to behave. They don't know if it's going to come back again next winter, whether we'll have treatments available, a vaccine. So everything is up in the air. So the government's basically crossing its fingers that the worst of it will be in the next maybe 2 to 3 months. They'll deal with it then, the economy will take a hit. These stimulus measures that the Chancellor announced yesterday will pick up the slack, will vaccinate the economy, as George Osborne said. And then after that, things will start returning to normal relatively quickly, but we just don't know for sure.
No, and this has largely stayed, it's not been a hugely political issue. The parties haven't really been going for each other on it. One exception to that really has been the row about sick pay and the kind of provision made for people who have to take time off work as a result of this. Are there still people, given yesterday's announcements, who might fall through the cracks here?
There are, and I've actually been speaking to them over the past few days, and I've got a few more who are desperate to speak to me next week as well. Cleaners for ambulances and hospitals mainly, but also in GP surgeries, who are outsourced workers who don't get statutory sick pay, and despite the Chancellor's announcements in the budget, they still are not eligible to statutory sick pay. He's changed a few tweaks to the benefits system that means that they'll be able to get employment support allowance earlier than you usually can, or if they're claiming universal credit, then it will disregard their, you know, their expected income, so they get higher payments. So those are the only two changes for people like that, and that's not enough. And even statutory sick pay in itself, if you are eligible for it, isn't very much. It's £94.25 a week. That's about £18 a day. People can't really live on that for very long. And that means people who are in the most vulnerable industries, so care work, hospitality, you know, even catering and chefs, cleaners, are in this situation where they have to choose between maybe missing their rent and falling behind on bills and not being able to provide for their family with the sort of meagre pay that they either get through statutory sick pay or through these benefits, or struggling into work when they really shouldn't be.
Which could, of course, make the problem worse. Yes. And
yeah,
go
exactly.
The
so it sounds niche. It sounds like it's not that many people, but it is the most crucial people.
Kevin, we heard the Chancellor being quizzed on this morning, the kind of level of statutory sick pay, and the question was sort of whether he could live on that. Is this an area where the government is potentially vulnerable as it responds to this?
Well, it is, because if you look in comparison to other Western economies, it is low. SSP is low in this country. Now, Boris Johnson was asked about it yesterday, and his answer was a bit of a feeble answer, really. He said, well, but we've got the NHS. Obviously, you know, people have medical treatment free at the point of delivery, which they don't have in other countries, which, no, it's a fair point, I suppose. You know, compare it to Ireland, I think statutory sick pay in Ireland's higher than here, but obviously they don't have an NHS. So, you know, it swings and roundabouts. But at the same time, it does, as I know she said, £18 a day, you know, you can live on that, not for very long though. And if people haven't to rely on that for any length of time, then obviously it's going to get very, very tough for them.
We had a pretty dramatic development in Westminster yesterday as well, with the news that Patient Safety Minister Nadine Dorries had become the first MP to be diagnosed with coronavirus. She's self-isolating now following the official advice. What else are officials doing in the wake of that diagnosis, and is there any sense that more MPs might be affected by this?
Yeah, well, I think the number now self-isolating is up to six. I think I saw Andrew Bridgen, I think, one of them. I saw that earlier, and also there's another minister whose name escapes me, health minister as well, had lunch.
Oh, Edward Argar.
Argar, that's it. Yeah. He had lunch with Nadine Dorries last week, so obviously he's now self-isolating. He's not symptomatic, but he is self-isolating. So, and you know, last night Matt Hancock, and I think Jacob Rees-Mogg this morning as well, was very insistent that Parliament will not close. And symbolically, I guess it's important that Parliament is open for lots of reasons, but symbolically it would just look bad if Parliament shut down. However, looking at it on a practical basis, you know, take the MPs out of the equation, you've got like thousands of just normal ordinary workers there, so why should they be putting their personal health at risk in order to make MPs look, you know, quite brave by keeping Parliament open? So I'd really think, unless there's an unexpected turn in this virus and, you know, we start to see a reduction in cases, which no one's expecting, then I think Parliament, if not, if it doesn't close entirely, I think we'll see a dramatic scaling back of when it's open, maybe just for essential emergency legislation, that type of thing. Because it just seems a bit pointless to keep it open when you've got MPs coming from all round the country, literally all corners of the UK, to come to Parliament and potentially, you know, spread it even more. So I think that's something that there'll be more and more pressure further down the lane for Parliament to actually close.
Anoush, does that feel to you like where it's headed here, that the closure of Parliament is pretty inevitable now?
Well, Kevin's actually absolutely right that, you know, if you think about the life of an MP in particular, they're going around the country, going to and from their constituencies all the time. They're meeting a lot of people, their constituents, you know, officials, foreign dignitaries, each other, journalists, you know, they're they're quite sort of uniquely placed to be spreading this virus. Mm. So, like you say, I do think it sounds a bit strange and irresponsible to keep it open with business as usual. Also, you know, what about the Lords? I was speaking to a member of the House of Lords last week who was saying that there's quite a lot of concern in the House of Lords in particular, because so many of them are older people and so more vulnerable to the virus in terms of what we know about it. So you've got to consider them as well. I understand the importance of symbolically of keeping it open, and also you need, you know, to keep scrutinising lawmakers and policy, especially during a sort of crisis period. But but perhaps this could lead to some kind of permanent changes in the way that Parliament's run as well, you know. Perhaps you shouldn't have to be physically present to vote in the House.
Because there have long been calls for things like remote working, you know, more kind of proxy voting, things like that. And of course, parliamentary authorities resisted that for a while. This might change that dynamic, you think?
Yeah, it might give way to the modernisation that lots of people have been calling for.
Kevin, we've also seen some dramatic steps around the world to try and combat this. Different countries have come up with different responses. Perhaps most dramatically, Italy's gone into a complete shutdown. We've also seen Donald Trump announce a ban on travel from Europe, apart from for US citizens, and managed to take a pop at the EU while he did it as well. Doesn't apply to the UK. And Germany has announced curbs on large gatherings. So why is Britain not going down the same route as some of these other countries?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, Ireland this morning, Leo Varadkar announced that schools, colleges and childcare facilities are going to close for 2 weeks as well. And they have got nothing like the number of cases that we have in this country. Now, Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock's mantra all along has been they're following the medical advice, the scientific advice. And they are no doubt getting very good advice. But ultimately, these are political decisions. And it's not just the medical people who are advising them. They have this behavioural unit within Number 10, colloquially called the Nudge Unit, which was set up by David Cameron, which is advises on human behaviour. They do very complicated mathematical modelling on how people will react to being told stuff by government. And their belief is that if we were to go into an Italian-style lockdown at this point, it would be too soon, and that people will ultimately get fatigued and bored of it and just start ignoring all these warnings, and then it would become counterproductive because they would just go back to doing what they were doing before, and you wouldn't basically get on top of the outbreak. So the feeling goes. In terms of school closures, I mean, we might hear later on that the schools are going to close, but the mood music coming out at Number 10 at the moment still seems to be that they're reluctant to go down that route, not least because of the economic impact of people having to take time off work, potentially healthcare workers, you know, police, real frontline responders who might, if their kids can't go to school and can't get childcare to cover it, then they have to take time off work, which again would be obviously counterproductive to the effort to tackle the disease. So that is the government's viewpoint. But politically, I think the more that people see other countries really going down a hardline route, China seems to have turned the tide a bit by obviously being very hardline, locking down entire cities and towns. If people look at that and say, well, hang on, it's working there, why aren't we doing it? That's when politically it becomes very difficult. And that's when I think you could see perhaps the political consensus that there is at the moment start to break down. You know, you can maybe see Labour might break ranks and say, well, hang on a minute, enough's enough. You know, the cases are still going up, and yet you're allowing kids to go to school, you're allowing sports events to go ahead, albeit with reduced capacities. Is this really wise? And maybe we just need to batten down the hatches and wait for it to pass. So it's a gamble, I think, Boris Johnson's taking right now. And yeah, you better hope it's one that pays off.
Anish, what have you made of the Prime Minister's response? I mean, he's not known for being, you know, very kind of serious. He's often quite a kind of jocular character. And it seems like in this case, he's very much been willing to sort of delegate to officials and experts and say, no, I'm going to be guided by the science. Have you been surprised by the nature of the response from the PM? Or?
I actually haven't. I think it's kind of been a classic Boris response, because he is a self-described delegator, isn't he? I mean, that's a sort of euphemistic way of putting it. But he's been talking a lot about cabinet government and trying to delegate to Matt Hancock, but also the roles of the chief medical officer, Chris Whitty, and the chief scientific advisor to the government. I think his name is Sir Patrick Vallance. They've had very, very hands-on roles. They've been doing a lot of media rounds. Every time Boris Johnson or other government ministers have spoken about their response to the virus, they've been saying, well, we follow the science. So I think it's been a sort of experts first approach, which actually, you're right, does jar quite a lot with sort of the messages coming out of the Vote Leave campaign all those years ago. So I think that's been quite reassuring from people who I've heard from. But nevertheless, as other countries have started responding differently to the UK, to the crisis, like Kevin said, it's, I think that that sort of trust has been changing. And Ipsos Mori did some polling that has shown that the Prime Minister's sort of honeymoon period is now over, and nearly half of the population now are saying they have negative opinions of him. So I don't know whether that's linked to the crisis in particular, but he was late to holding that first COBRA meeting. Mm-hmm. And I think he has appeared as an individual on the back foot.
So the ground could shift quite quickly here if public opinion changes. Kevin, do you get the sense the government could come under enough political pressure to change its response, even if the official advice perhaps doesn't quite go that way?
Yeah, I mean, they can always listen to whatever advice they want. I mean, ultimately, it's the old cliche, isn't it? Advisors advise, but ministers decide. And if you start seeing polling evidence that people are demanding tougher action and that they would be willing to essentially shut themselves in their houses for 2 weeks or however long it takes, then I think politically it would be very difficult for Boris Johnson to hold this line. Oh, well, but the scientists and the medical experts are telling us, no, it's too early. I mean, it feels like it's inevitable it's going to come at some point. And it's whether he can time it right so that he gets the credit for it, rather than it looking like he's been forced into an embarrassing U-turn by events.
Now, in normal times, the budget would be all we're talking about today, but it's sort of taken a back seat to this rolling crisis. It already feels a little bit like old news to be talking about the budget 24 hours later. But it was a eye-catching budget, billed by the Chancellor in a very kind of Vote Leave style as the budget to get it done, whatever it might be. It seemed to be whatever he thought it was at that moment. What was the kind of big picture? What was the big takeaway from this budget, Kevin?
Well, the big takeaway was spend, spend, spend. I mean, the OBR, the Office for Budget Responsibilities report on it was quite eye-catching. They had a paragraph saying that it was bigger in terms of a sustained giveaway by the government, bigger than anything that Gordon Brown even did, even his famous 2000 budget, which was the one where after the first couple of years of the new Labour government, they stuck to the previous Tory spending plans. It turned on the spending tab, massive increase in NHS spending, cut income tax, you know, really, really went for it. But it was even bigger in terms of the numbers than that. You have to go back to 1992 budget, Norm Lamont, before the 92 election. He had this mad giveaway budget basically to bribe the country to vote Tory, and it did work, to be fair. But it's not since then have we had a budget where so much has been given away, which is quite surprising, because I thought that we were still trying to pay down the deficit. That seems to have just gone now. You know, we spent 10 years, that was the main political debate in this country, was paying down the deficit, getting the debt under control, and that's just gone out the window. I mean, it depends what figures you want to believe. I mean, 600 billion was tossed around as a infrastructure spending over the next however length of time. You know, as always, there's always a lot of smoke and mirrors. The Treasury won't, you think that they're being incredibly generous, but in actual fact, that's actually not the case. But yeah, it was all about spending. It wasn't an austerity budget like George Osborne in 2010. It was very much, you know, we've been through the tough times. Now this is, we've got a new government, we've got a new approach. Here you go. Well, we're going to spend like crazy. And it's mindful as well, I think, of the red wall seats that they won at the general election. You know, they're desperate to hold on to those voters. And if they can point to, well, hang on a minute, we're building a new road there, or railways, new houses, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter how much it costs, as long as they hang on to those voters. But again, with the economy being as unpredictable as at the moment, it's a huge, huge gamble.
Anoush, who are the big beneficiaries of this budget? Which kind of areas of the state are going to get much more cash pumped into them?
I think the main big break with the past Tory chancellors and even Labour chancellors is the spend on infrastructure. So it's, you know, the borrowing is going to be at a record high to try and pump money into rail, into roads. You know, there's going to be a West Yorkshire mayoralty. So it's all with the regions in mind. And there was a focus on Northern Powerhouse Rail as well. But if you actually look at the detail, not every region outside of London is really getting that much out of this, or at least it hasn't been spelled out yet. So the Northern Powerhouse Rail, which is the part of, you know, rail upgrades that cities in the north want to run from east to west, it's only focused on the Manchester to Leeds leg of it. So Liverpool and Hull have kind of been left out of that equation in this budget. And there hasn't been that much focus on the towns that everyone has been speaking about, you know, since Theresa May's prime ministership. That nothing specific has really been said about those kind of smaller towns. And in terms of day-to-day spending, aside from what the government promised in their manifesto to spend on the NHS and police and education, there isn't actually that much more for public services or the departments that aren't protected by those promises. So austerity kind of continues, but underneath the radar. And even with the police numbers and their education spending, less so with the NHS, the jury's out on whether that extra money is ever going to build those services back to a pre-2010 level. So, you know, the state has been cut, and it's been cut for good. In this budget, there's nothing for local authorities aside from a few changes in the way that they can build social housing and other kind of infrastructure projects. There's no changing to that funding model, and local authorities have been cut by more than half since 2010. And as I spoke about before, social care, which is the big kind of ticking time bomb under the UK economy. It's just unsustainable. We've got an ageing population, but also more working age people need access to care that they're not getting. And nothing was brought in for that. They're still saying they want a sort of cross-party consensus on it. They've been saying that for a really long time.
Thank God the Prime Minister's got a plan.
Yeah.
So we're okay.
Yeah, he did say he did. So
was it the first 100 days plan, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He said he had it on the day that he... On the day he went in. We have a plan for social care.
We've got a letter.
Still waiting to see it, yeah. He didn't even write the letter. It was Matt Hancock's letter.
You can take that to the bank, though, can't you? A letter from Matt Hancock. We also didn't... I mean, Sajid Javid, of course, kind of loomed large over this budget. Yeah. He walked out of the cabinet a few weeks ago, seems like years ago, amid a big row with Number 10. We didn't see his fiscal rules ditched, as some had expected. Have they been stretched to the absolute limit?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah, they've not been broken, but they're in a pretty grim state of disrepair. I mean, they're reviewing the fiscal rules, and I think they're going to go eventually. I mean, the whole point of the fiscal rules was to give the impression of prudence. You know, they're still spending, but, you know, no borrowing for day-to-day, and that there would be a cap on the amount that could be borrowed. You could borrow a lot while interest rates are low, as they are at the moment, but should that change in the future, then you'd have to claw back on borrowing. Those, I think, won't last. I think clearly Boris Johnson's got his own man now in Number 11. As much as, you know, it wasn't the plan, I think, to get rid of Sajid Javid, certainly not in the reshuffle, you could tell that this was, as much as it was Rishi Sunak's budget, it was very much a Number 10 Downing Street, Dominic Cummings, Boris Johnson budget. You know, as I say, it's those red wall seats. Give the impression that we're not like Tories, we're not Thatcherites. We're actually quite Labour-y when it comes to the economy, and we like to spend lots and lots of money. One thing I will say, though, is that Rishi Sunak, considering he'd only become Chancellor a month ago, I thought, just presentationally, it was an excellent budget. You know, I thought he was at ease at the dispatch box. You would never have known it was his first budget. I thought he was really good. Better, probably, than Sajid Javid would have been. Sajid was a bit robotic, a little bit stiff, never really seemed fully relaxed, whereas Rishi Sunak is one smooth operator, and definitely one to watch for the future.
Future leadership material.
Without a doubt, but I mean, God, we can never predict anything in politics these days. But certainly, whenever Boris Johnson inevitably, you know, shoots himself in the foot, I think Rishi Sunak will be there or thereabouts.
Did this big spending budget strike you as a kind of one-off to account for what looks like a slowing global economy, or is this the new game in town as far as the Tories are concerned?
Well, we won't have long to wait to find out. There's another one in the autumn, and there's also going to be a comprehensive spending review. So we'll find out whether, you know, this is a, I mean, I don't, ultimately they are Tories, they are Conservatives, so they're not going to spend forever. I think this is a first attempt to repaint the government, but you know, they're at the mercy of events as much as anything, you know. And if interest rates go up, if this global recession, I think, turns into a depression, because that's the other thing, there isn't that much firepower that governments have compared to in 2008. Interest rates are already very low. Central banks really don't have much in their armoury to protect the global economy in the way that they did in 2008. So things could get really, really, really dicey. And, you know, if you've already had 10 years of austerity, it could be even worse going forward.
Anoush, obviously we did have extra cash going into a kind of all manner of areas yesterday, but if we kind of look at the broader picture of 2010 to now, and perhaps projecting forward to 2025, which bits of the state will have fundamentally changed over that period? What will government not be doing or be doing less of than it was doing, you know, at the end of the New Labour years?
Well, I think we've already seen some examples of that over the past few years. So, you know, things like children's services, Sure Start, they've been cut. And all of the sort of local services that you'd be used to seeing, particularly in the sort of New Labour years, like youth clubs, like, you know, community centres where people gather, libraries, even job centres, you know, they've been cut as well. So all of these places where people could gather either for information or help or just socially, they've kind of been chipped away. I don't have the exact figures off the top of my head, but they're really, really stark. Like even public parks and things like that are being slowly built upon by private developers. And that's something that I think is going to be, it's going to change the map of what the UK looks like, particularly its cities, in the next, you know, 10, 15 years. And that, you know, that's what the UN special rapporteur who came here to study austerity in the UK said. He said the sort of social fabric of the country is changing, and the, what it means to sort of be living in a community in the UK is changing because of this sort of loss of public space. And it's quite intangible. It's difficult to kind of, you know, calculate, but it's changing the picture of what it's like to live in Britain. And I think once those things are gone, they don't come back because they're seen as a luxury. So in a time where, like you say, the economy is so volatile and Tories are Tories and they want a smaller state and never, you know, regardless of the budget that we've just had, they still want to keep those kind of principles in place. I think we're going to have that a much more different looking country, and it's going to feel different to live in as well.
It's quite a sort of nuanced political argument to make. Do you think there's still any kind of political capital left for Labour in talking about austerity and talking about cuts now, or are the kind of headline figures probably gonna spike those guns?
Well, what's really interesting, because I think Labour are quite bad at talking about this, even though it affects everyone's day-to-day lives. There's been a lot of poverty, like academics and campaigners, who have been working out how to speak to the public about cuts and poverty, because it's really off-putting to read about that stuff. You don't want to believe that it's happening if it's not happening to you, and if it is happening to you, you don't have time to read about it and you don't want to know the figures. You're just trying to get through your life. So they've been sort of researching and focus grouping how best to speak about this stuff, and it's got to be much more positive. I know that sounds contradictory, but there's got to be a much more hope in the messaging that we can come out of this, and that poverty isn't, you're not doomed to poverty, and we're not doomed to services disappearing, and that people are trapped in it rather than people are sort of, you know, it's unfair or unjust, because people will say, well, life's unfair. So there's lots of different sort of language changes that Labour could try and absorb from that kind of research that's happening. But also, I think Labour have been very lofty in the way that they've approached it. You know, pubs are closing. That's a huge thing. That's a big change in people's lives. Why don't they speak more about that? Why don't they speak more about parks, post offices, stuff that matters to people's day-to-day lives, particularly in those constituencies that aren't necessarily, you know, solid Labour? You know, everyone's grandparents will notice that their post office has disappeared from down the road, but they probably didn't like Jeremy Corbyn very much. So I do think they've got to completely rethink the way they talk about it, but this is affecting people, so it can chime with them if you find the right language to use.
Kevin, do you get the sense any of the Labour leadership candidates are kind of getting ready to adjust to the new kind of Conservative mantra and the way of doing things?
I think they're just too wrapped up at the moment in the leadership contest, which has been going on for so long, and thank God, the end is in sight, despite the fact we found out today that the actual conference itself will probably end up not happening because of the coronavirus. But be that as it may, I think 4th of April we will definitely have a new Labour leader, and maybe then they can get back on the pitch when it comes to the economy. Because, I mean, John McDonnell did his best yesterday. He was okay on the TV and everything this morning, but he is halfway out the door, really. It doesn't really matter what John McDonnell says anymore about the economy, because he's not going to be Shadow Chancellor for this time next month. So, yeah, the leaders, the leadership contenders, yeah, they just weren't at the races yesterday, and Labour weren't at the races. Jeremy Corbyn's response to the Chancellor's speech was just, I mean, it was like he sleptwalked through it, you know, he was just going through the motions. So, yeah, that is going to have to, they're now going to face a serious Conservative machine, whoever wins, probably Keir Starmer, and they're going to have to get on it very, very quickly, or else, you know, already the next election probably looks a big ask.
Are you picking up any disquiet from Conservative MPs about this new approach from the Prime Minister and the Chancellor?
Well, yeah, I mean, getting back to what we said earlier, you know, Tories are Tories, and ultimately they didn't get into politics to spend tons and tons of money racking up the national debt, sticking it on the country's credit card, and to spend lots of money on public services. That's just not what they're about. So they can probably understand the short-term political gain and why the budget was the way it was yesterday. But, you know, there's no way they're going to sit and accept that for the next 5 years. And also, there's already rumblings, you know, just on other issues. Huawei is a big thing, you know. We saw Boris Johnson, you know, that's another thing we've probably won't get time to speak about, but, you know, big rebellion, big Tory rebellion over Huawei, shot across the bows. You know, he's got an 80 seat majority, but, you know, all it takes is 41 Tories to vote against him and he's gone, or that's gone, I should say. HS2 is another issue where Tory MPs are not happy that it's going ahead. So, you know, it's not as if the horizon is clear for Boris Johnson. You know, he is vulnerable in certain areas, but at the moment the opposition is coming from the Tory backbenches rather than the official opposition.
Anoush, budgets sometimes have a habit of coming unstuck the day after. I think we're all old enough to remember the pasty tax and George Osborne's troubles back in the early...
I certainly am.
Early 2010s. You don't look it though, Kevin.
Oh,
you don't look it. Checks in the post, I presume. has there been anything so far that's kind of sounded any alarm bells here? Anything where the wheels might have come off a little?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have been talking about the fact that there were no provisions for childcare, like nurseries and childcare services in terms of the coronavirus. And also, although this pledge to sort of extend statutory sick pay to people who are self-isolating without symptoms and those who are caring for people self-isolating without symptoms didn't really mention parents in particular. So I think there's either been a lack of communication or an omission for people who are going to have to stay at home and look after their kids if schools are shut. So I think that's starting to unravel a bit, and I'm sure that it's just a case of tacking on the detail rather than it being sort of on purpose. But I think that sort of spooked people. And in terms of more in general, I mean, if you look at the sort of fuel duty freeze and the alcohol duty freeze, which hasn't been frozen, I think this is the second time it's been frozen in 20 years. So it's quite unfashionable. Those two things kind of put up red flags to me. I mean, they always freeze fuel duty, but this was supposed to be a different kind of budget. It suggests that they are still trying to pander to those Conservative MPs who want the more traditional kind of Conservative approach to the economy, and they seem like they're kind of like a few scraps of red meat thrown to the back benches, and I think that suggests that there is some kind of knowledge in Number 10, despite them wanting to, you know, focus all on that red to blue wall, that they've still got some people, probably quite a significant section of people on their back benches who they have to placate.
Now, onto a section of the podcast that, for copyright reasons, we have to point out is nothing like You Ask Us on the New Statesman podcast. This is the distinctly different listener's question.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which,
completely different.
They ask you.
Absolutely. Very, very different affair. So Shane Halfpenny Ray has asked a couple of questions. I'll throw them open to both of you guys, so feel free to jump in. It's a very nice name. It's a very nice name. So Shane says, do you think the coronavirus measures announced yesterday go far enough?
I mean, I think you could always make the argument that they could go further, but I think in the circumstances it was a pretty comprehensive package. I mean, Anoush has touched on it, there will still be people who lose out financially. It's just impossible, I think, to cover absolutely everyone. So I suppose the honest answer to the question is no, it didn't go far enough. However, politically, I'm not sure he could have gone. He could have gone any further, really.
Anoush, any dissent?
I think he had to be careful not to strike too alarmist a tone because of what it could do to markets, but also to public sort of well-being. Mm. So I think he struck the right tone, and I think some of these measures for businesses are, you know, going to save some businesses through this really difficult period. But in terms of the sick pay and benefits, I think that it was a bit of smoke and mirrors, and I don't think it was enough.
So leading on brilliantly to the next question, what more could the government do in terms of self-employed and zero-hour workers, as well as people under the statutory sick pay limit?
So, yeah, these are the people who are missing out. So I think that they could either force those big contractors for hospitals and cleaners to pay either full pay or increased sick pay to their workers while they have time off. They seem to be able to sort of drop everything and run everything when they want to, so I don't see why they can't do that either. And then maybe in the longer term, look at increasing statutory sick pay because the actual level of it, as we've already spoken about, isn't very high.
This is a question from Vicky Wong, who we both used to work with.
Yeah.
Hi, Vicky. Vicky asks, has this budget put to bed accusations that Rishi Sunak is Chancellor in name only, or Chino?
Well, yeah, we kind of touched on this. I think it was clearly, I know that I wrote a piece comparing them to Gordon Murphy, it was like a Gordon Brown budget. The difference there, obviously, is that Gordon Brown and Tony Blair didn't get on. Mm-hmm. Whereas, and Gordon basically wrote his own budget and I think told Tony Blair what was in it like the previous night. You know, I mean, there was absolutely no input from number 10 at all. This was very different. Clearly, this has been written as a joint operation. Now, well, the reason that Sajid Javid went is because he didn't want this joint economic unit between number 10 and number 11. So, yeah, I think it doesn't, it certainly does not mean that he's not Chancellor in name only. That said, I still thought it was a fairly impressive performance, but early days, you know, we'll see how this brave new world of cooperation between number 10 and number 11, how long that lasts, because, you know, behind the scenes, the Treasury still likes to rule the roost when it comes to, obviously, departmental spending, and there is still room for tension there, despite what Dominic Cummings, what schemes he might have dreamt up to try and give the illusion that they're one big happy family.
Last question from Vicky. Vicky asks, how are you guys recording this podcast, and why aren't you social distancing? I guess I can sort of feel the first bit. We're recording the podcast with the usual microphone we found in a bin somewhere. You couldn't get any more low tech than we already are,
that
so we've
true.
Not had to make any kind of cuts or anything. Why aren't we social distancing, guys? I feel like I have been my whole life. I don't know.
Well, you know, I just had to come to the Shard to get some hand sanitizer, so that's why I'm here.
Help yourself.
Well, we're asymptomatic, so I don't want to scare anyone, but it doesn't mean to say we don't have it, but I feel fine right now, so I think we're probably safe, but who knows, this could be the last podcast for a while.
Oh, that's a dark note to end on.
Jesus, that's a terrifying prospect. Just say sure for everyone.
Public Health England advises you can't catch coronavirus from listening to podcasts, so please do keep tuned in. And of course, subscribe to our 7 day a week breakfast briefing email, which will arrive in your inbox around about 7 o'clock every morning, politicshome.com/register. Also subscribe to the New Statesman so you can read and support everything Anoush does. Thank you both for joining me on the podcast this week. That's all we've got time for. Have a great one.